Welcome to the Lavo Show podcast. Conversations with outstanding human beings whose love has been inspired and transformed by Osho. Take a deep breath and enjoy the show.
Hello and thanks for tuning in. My name is Swaram and I'm the host. Today our guest is Swami Prem Anam. Anam took sannyas in 1973 and was one of the first therapists to work directly under Osho's guidance leading primal groups in Pune. Today, Anam continues his work as a therapist and is a regular contributor to the German Osho Times. I'm so happy to have Anam on the show and I hope you enjoy it. Anam, welcome to the show. How are you?
Thank you very much. I'm feeling very excited about this interview. My health is good, which is a good thing to say in this particular time. And I'm ready.
Okay, so to start, tell us a little bit about how you came across Osho.
How I came across him initially was by the sannyasins that were returning to London, where I was living. I grew up in, I spent my teenage years, my early adolescence in London, and there was a lot going on in terms of what they call the human potential movement. People who started working on themselves, using all of the different processes which were at the time coming over mostly from the United States. And I'd begun to work on myself in this way, going to self-exploration groups. And I actually had signed up for a therapist training. And the people that were, that opened the first growth center, as it was called, in London, took sannyas themselves. They'd been over in the States, they'd worked with people at the Esalen Institute in California, and they started a center, Kwesito, in London, where various therapists, pioneers actually, in Gestalt therapy, bioenergetics, etc., were coming over and working there. But the person, I mean, there's basically one strong influence for the actual step that I took into taking sannyas. And this person was called Sudha. She's no longer alive. But I'd never met anybody quite like her before. She was from Spanish Harlem, and I completely admired her. You know, she had this wit, intelligence, aliveness, spark, and I couldn't at first understand why somebody like that would want or need a guru. The concept of guru was familiar to me. I spent my childhood in Sri Lanka. I was very familiar with that kind of terminology. And of course, you know, growing up in London, the Beatles went to see Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, you know, meditation, mysticism, all of that. You know, it was coming in, it was being introduced into the Western world in that way. I didn't particularly feel like I needed a guru, but I have to say, the first time I saw Osho's photograph on the locket of a mala, and I took one look at this locket, and I knew something was up. You know, I felt something. I was doing a lot of weekend groups and so on at the time. And in one of these weekend workshops, I participated in dynamic meditation for the first time. This was in the very early 70s. The effects of it was so phenomenal, you know, I was completely turned on to this meditation.
That was very early 70s, and it's actually even before Osho established the commune in Pune. So how did you take sannyas, and how did you receive your name, and how that kind of things were handled at the time before Osho was actually in Pune?
Okay, in those days, if you wanted to take sannyas, you either went to see him in India. Friends of mine had done it in meditation camps in Mount Abu. They'd been initiated in his apartment in Woodlands in Bombay. It was also possible to get a mala from any of the meditation centers. Well, actually, there weren't that many. I think Bell Street, London was one of the first in the world. And I did the meditation course. And, you know, taking sannyas was not like a clear decision. It was almost like a compulsion. I knew I had to do this, which was unusual, you know, in those days to wear bright orange clothes and a wooden bead necklace around your neck. I was working in an architect's office at the time. I was working during the day. I was doing my therapist training at weekends and several evenings during the week. So the idea of just wearing one color for the rest of my life was not really a turn-on, but actually I liked the color orange. I just didn't want to give up all of the other colors that I was wearing. But I followed this instinct, this strong feeling that this was something that I was going to do. And I went to the meditation center after work on what was Osho's birthday. The meditation center was in the basement. Went in there. Veena was preparing for the celebration of Osho's birthday. I think she was making guacamole. And I went up to her and I whispered in her ear, I want to take sannyas. So she took me into the room where the malas were kept. She basically put the mala around my neck, gave me a hug, and off I went to my therapist training meeting that evening. In those days, it was the way it was to write a letter to Osho in Bombay and request your name that way. I did that, and no name came. And shortly after that, a lot of people left to fly to India, to Mount Abu for a meditation camp. And Veena was one of these people. She'd been leaving the center and off she went to India. And somebody else from my house also went with that group of people to Mount Abu. And he actually took sannyas on the same day as I did. And he wrote to Osho saying, you know, don't send me a name. I'm coming to the next meditation camp. But he actually got his name before he left. And I kept waiting and no name appeared. How I did get the name in the end was that several months after Sudha, my inspiration in all of this, came back from having spent probably about a year or so in India, in Kailash, which was an ashram that Osho created in the jungle somewhere in the middle of India. And she thought it was very moving, very amazing, very amusing that I hadn't got a name and that I'd been waiting all this time. So she decided to write a letter and suggest which name I should receive. So she had some input into this. And the name I received means nameless love or love of the nameless. And it felt right, you know, this name from the start just felt so right.
That's wonderful. So I didn't quite catch it. Was it Sudha who actually suggested the name? Or
she suggested the name in a letter that she wrote to Osho.
Okay, and then Osho said, okay, that suits you.
Then I got a letter back. I got a handwritten letter back from, I don't think it was Lakshmi directly, I think it was somebody that was working for her. But that was how I got the name.
Beautiful. So as I mentioned in the introduction, you were one of the first therapists to work directly under Osho's guidance, and you were leading primal groups since 1976. So therapy groups have played a big role in Osho's world in those days and even today. I mean, there are lots of therapists offering all sorts of groups in the world of Osho. So can you give us a sense of how Osho managed the introduction of a particular therapy group and how he managed the relationship with the therapists? And what do you mean when you say that Osho was guiding you?
Okay, in those days, all of the groups, I mean, in those days, there were three groups set up. By the time I got to Pune, which was a couple of years after I actually got my mala, when I actually got to Pune, there was Encounter, there was Primal, and there was what was called Enlightenment Intensive, which is the process that's now known as Huizen. When Osho created, or when the ashram was created in Pune, there were people who were already there, who were skilled and experienced in working with technique. One of them was A woman named at the time Divya, who set up the Primal Group, she'd been working with Arthur Yanov, who created Primal Therapy. There was a man who's known as Tefa, who was a skilled encounter group leader. And there was, if I remember rightly, there was Arup Garimo, who set up the Enlightenment Intensive. And when I mean by guidance, each group, all the participants and the therapists went to see Osho in the evening darshans so he could supervise. Basically, he would ask the therapist how the group was going, and he would talk to most, if not all, of the participants to find out what their experience was. And in my case, I stepped in to Primal when Divya stepped out. And basically, whoa, how can I say this? You know, there was we used to go twice a month, once in the Primal groups were 2 weeks long. We would go in the middle of the group and we would go at the end. And in the middle of the group, he would talk to people about what they were experiencing and then look over at me or one of the others in the Primal team and ask if we had something to say about this. And he would actually make suggestions. You know, he would say things like, tomorrow you try so-and-so. And then he would want feedback about how his suggestions had worked. He would also, now he was quite, when I talk about guidance, you know, sometimes he would be quite tough on me. I can remember a case where I did talk about personal, I was mixing my personal issues with my issues of, or, you know. Once I got a very strong critique about bringing my personal issues into the group darshan, and that I should need to come and see him privately rather than in front of, bring my issues up in front of the group. So it was like, you know, he was a boss, he was a mentor, and he was the inspiration for basically the way that I worked.
You just mentioned something quite significant there. As a therapist, you have your own personal things, and it's almost inevitable that you bring your things in your life and in your work. So what was the suggestion and the advice on how you keep those things?
Okay, now you really asked me something. Okay, when I started doing this job, okay, Lakshmi, who was Osho's secretary at the time, had this phrase that she would keep throwing at me. You therapists, it's not you, it's his energy through you. Okay, now, I was 25, 26 at the time. I didn't really understand what she was talking about. But basically, she was indicating that my own personal stuff should not get in the way of the work. Okay, how I have learned this in the meantime, how I have absorbed, digested, and put this into practice in the meantime, this is all about creating and building presence in the work. How have I done that? Basically, it's about being in meditation while you're working. I was a young man. I didn't have that much experience. I had, you know, quite a good, thorough training, but I didn't have that much experience. And in the beginning, when we were working in the therapy chambers, you know, the wall, the back wall of the underground therapy chambers actually was on the border of the property with Osho's house. You know, they were like adjacent to each other. And I would get a distinct feeling that my back was covered if I sat in a position with my back to the wall. You know, this whole thing about it's not you, it's his energy through you. It's quite a koan to work with. How do you get your stuff out of the way? Obviously, you know, working on yourself, becoming familiar with your own issues and getting more aware of your attitudes, your emotions, and getting clearer helps. But there's also, well, actually, is the most part of the work. But coming to yourself, being present, being able to be there with somebody else, you know, feeling whatever it is that you're feeling, and being compassionate in this way with whoever's going through something that's significant and valuable for them. Yeah, that's the training. A lot of my learning was learning by doing, and then being constantly supervised by checking in with Osho regularly.
But still, it's quite difficult to put the fingers on this. How would then Osho give you feedback and say, well, you are on the right path? I mean, what were the signs that you were doing okay?
He would be very direct. You know, he gave very direct feedback.
Okay, so it sounds that this is really the core secret for successful therapies. So would you agree with that?
What do you define by successful therapy? His discourses very often were completely against or criticizing the methods of therapy. You know, I would sit for at least 1.5 hours a day in discourse, listening to him talking about various topics. And very often he would hammer on Western psychological methods. And within 20 minutes of the discourse ending, I would have to go down into the therapy chambers and work still with that stuff, you know, churned up inside of me. So within that paradox, I would say, you know, I could only trust what I was doing, what my colleagues were doing, was on the right track. And if it wasn't, then we would hear about it more personally when we went to see them.
I'm very grateful that you brought it up, because it's true that Osho, on one hand, it's a big paradox. On one hand, Osho introduced therapy to help people in their spiritual growth. On the other hand, he was hammering psychology and therapists, all the time. So it's a big, another big koan of Osho, definitely.
It's an ongoing koan, you know, he never finished with this. And basically, you know, towards the end of his time here on the planet, he created meditative therapies, you know, the Mystic Rose, No Mind Meditation, and I think...
Born Again.
Born Again, exactly. And he created these specifically for a reason, that, you know, they were blending therapeutic techniques with meditation, and it would be possible for people to do this without very much guidance.
Okay, well, let's change gear and talk about more present day. And we are currently living a very strange time. We are going through a unique time with the world in lockdown due to the coronavirus. So for many, it's a time of big uncertainty and confusion. How, for you personally, living with Osho prepared you for this kind of times? I mean, during your life with Osho, you guys were living on the edge. Things changing all the time, and there is always a little bit of uncertainty. So what have you learned from Osho that is helping you facing this time today?
To face uncertainty, to face insecurity consciously, you know, to recognize that there is a state of helplessness, you know, whatever the media and whatever input we've been getting about this, you know, there's a whole lot of stuff about conspiracy theories, there's stuff about, you know, manufactured viruses, etc., etc., etc. There's stories about how 5G has an influence in creating this sort of situation. There's a big unknown element. Nobody knows. Nobody knows how the world will be when we come through this. Nobody knows where we're headed. So I think facing uncertainty, facing insecurity consciously is valuable, is extremely valuable. In my memories, we were always not only just on the precipice, you know, we were always on the verge of moving somewhere. The commune was mostly on the move. You know, first we were looking for properties in the Seychelles, and then in Gujarat in India, then in Saslot, which was very close to Pune, and then we moved to America. You know, when the move to Saslot was announced, people actually had trunks packed with stuff, because Saslot was in the, in Gujarat, was in the middle of, was nowhere, and people even, you know, I know people who packed trunks full of soap and all of the things that they didn't think they were going to be able to get in Gujarat. On the ranch, we were always working in crunch mode, getting buildings completed before the building permits were retracted, before they were taken away by the local authorities. So yes, there was an enormous state of uncertainty, state of insecurity, and that became a regular practice to kind of still move, still keep enjoying, still keep living, still keep up the vitality, aliveness, and somehow to center ourselves within that. I think that's a very valuable thing to have learned. And at the moment, I'm finding it enormously useful.
Definitely, and thank you for that. I mean, at the end of the day, life is uncertain all the times. You know, death is unpredictable, and it can come at any time, but we don't think. So just this time, things are kind of magnified. You know, this coronavirus situation is exposing our fragility and uncertainty, but in reality, we forget about it. But life is uncertain, and you being with Osho, he was kind of teaching you this lesson, maybe.
Yeah, this lesson came in, actually, you know, in discourse form or in a practical form. One of the things that I was reminded of in these last days was, you know, within the first month, it was just after I started leading primal groups there, there was a young sannyasin, Vipassana, and she was roughly around the same age as me. You know, we were friends. And very suddenly, she ended up in the hospital with a brain tumor. And she was in coma in the hospital. So there was a discourse question about her. And during the discourse, Osho recommended that we all go to Ruby Hall Hospital and sit with her and look very consciously at death and dying. Here again is another scene that sticks in my memory very clearly. It was quite beautiful, you know, going to Ruby Hall Hospital, and there you see throughout the hospital grounds, along the corridors, and in the ward she was in, sannyasins in resplendent orange and malas, you know, dotted around the place in meditation, and around her bed, you know, we sat and meditated. And that was a very, very strong input. You know, death could happen any time. I mean, she did die after a few days, and we gave her the first celebratory send-off in my experience. And that was also a major transition in my personal approach to death. You know, death had been mystified for me. Osho called us all into a very special discourse in the evening before we carried her body to the burning ghats in Pune, and it was the first time that I danced and sang around the funeral pyre. You know, this was strange, weird, and yet I was doing it, and yet I was feeling the effects of it. And that, you know, instilled something which still lasts until today.
Okay, so coming to your profession and your work, I understand that you're still continue your work as a therapist, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you also contribute with articles to the German Osho Times. So what are your current projects, and what kind of groups are you leading at the moment?
At the moment, I'm not doing any groups. At the moment, I'm home most of the time, but I should have been returning today or tomorrow from a process known as Who Am I Without My Story in Turkey. And before that, I had to postpone two primal groups in Moscow and in Irkutsk, close to the Baikal Lake, I mean, everything's on hold at the moment.
I appreciate that everything is on hold, but what I mean is, you know, before and regardless of the coronavirus lockdown.
Primal is something that's been in my toolbox for, what is it now, 45 years? And it's still something that I think is one of the most valuable tools that I've ever learned. And it's, for me, when I do it, it's like putting on a familiar old suit. And the other process that I really, really enjoy doing is called Who Am I Without My Story? And this is 3 days of awareness intensive, Who Am I, working with the koan, and 2 days of coming out of the process with creative structures and meditation. So it integrates the process, brings it into a more everyday, workable, practical tool.
And do you work predominantly within Osho communities, or you work with the people who perhaps don't even know Osho?
I do both. I work as a coach together with my wife, Martina. We have a coaching company, and it's mostly with people who don't know Osho. And there's a whole younger generation now who are not familiar with Osho, but we use Osho's techniques for all of the work that I do, whether it's in the world of Osho or is what I call in the coaching work that I do, we use dynamic, we use Kundalini, as well as whatever other meditations are necessary. The basic techniques in starting the day and closing the day, dynamic and Kundalini. It's about half and half, I would say. You know, countries like Russia, opening up, people look more than curious, more than enthusiastic about Osho. And for me, it's a thrill to travel to such places where, as a child in Sri Lanka, I never ever imagined that I would go. So this life of sannyas has taken me into territories that are beyond my imagination from way back then. And this adventure keeps on going. I'll be 70 in 2 days, and I don't see myself giving up working just yet. In fact, you know, I still feel a lot of joy, a lot of pleasure, a lot of, aliveness, keeping on doing this work. So, and also, you know, it might be that the outer appearances that are out there are people who are, you know, consciously turned onto Osho, the gathering groups organized by sannyasins to explore more of who they are. And then there are people who are sent by their bosses, by their companies, to work with us in a coaching situation. And, you know, people are people. People have a thirst. People have a need to connect with qualities inside of themselves, and I don't see the difference in a massive way. You know, people are people.
Okay, so where people can find you if they want to get in touch with you?
I don't have at the moment a big website. There's a company website. Coaching company is called People in Process.
So I have three final questions for you.
Three final questions, okay.
Yeah, so the first one is, what's your morning routine? How does your morning look like in the first couple of hours of your day?
Okay, in the first couple of hours, well, right now, these days, I stay in bed a bit longer. I mean, this is my morning routine is my morning routine in a lockdown situation. I get out of bed. We've had brilliant weather here in Hamburg, so I go out along the Ulster with my Nordic walking sticks. And I find that, you know, a really, really wonderful way to start the day. Fresh air, exercise. It's cold, but it's sunny. Then I come back and I have my breakfast, and I look at, the practical needs, emails and so on. If I have appointments, I attend to those. Otherwise, I'm very busy with my creativity. You know, this lockdown situation has given me space to slow down and be creative and spend, like I said, you know, slowing down. I paint a lot. I'm an enthusiastic hobby painter. I've been actually literally watching paint dry. I can take more time to spend on being creative, and I've been enjoying that. Other than that, you know, I'm creative in the kitchen. I like to cook, so I spend time there. There's a lot of contact been opened up during this time of lockdown, time of crisis. I have contact with friends that I haven't seen or heard of for quite a while, and that does my heart good. It feels like there's a sense of community coming together over media, over Facebook, FaceTime, Skype, etc., etc. And I enjoy sharing and making contact with friends, you know.
Okay, so the second question is, what's your favorite meditation and why?
My absolute favorite is dancing. Not in Nataraj for sure, but, you know, just dancing anyway. And I think I would say dynamic would hold equal place. And it is the first method that I was turned onto. It was Osho's first original creation as a meditation. And I would say it's been the most effective in my life. And I kept doing it personally, you know, not every day, but in whenever it was possible or needed, until just a little bit more than 5 years ago when I started. I had heart failure and I needed to have work done. I have an implanted defibrillator in my body, which makes it undesirable for me to do overexertive movements and so on. So dynamic is that. But I use dancing whenever I can. I use Nadabrahm. Oh, and the Atisha heart meditation. There's more than one there. But yeah, I would say dancing and dynamic are top of the list.
So the last question is, you live the Osho experiment. You are one of the pioneers in this movement of creating the new man, Zorba the Buddha. What does it mean to you personally to be with Osho today in 2020?
Whoa, what does it mean to me personally? It means actually to have consider myself quite privileged to have had these experiences. They haven't by any means all been a picnic. It means that I still keep looking at issues in a particular way, looking at what does it mean to be the new man, means looking at my attitudes, looking at what I've learned in the past about certain issues, and look at how my life experiences have taught me whether those issues, whether these attitudes are still relevant in my life now, according to my experiences, or whether there need to be some adjustments, some changes needed. And also, there's been such, you know, learning to love myself is still an ongoing process. So yeah, I would say Osho's guidance, Osho's influence is primary. It's the strongest of anybody's that I can recall. And it's still there. You know, there are moments when I sit still and I am in silence, and it's real. You know, there is silence. I feel my heart, and I'm just grateful that I've learned these things.
Okay, and I'm very grateful to you for your time and for your contribution and for sharing your story and your love for Osho. So that's the end of the interview, and I send you a big hug and lots of love.
Wow, thank you. Thank you very much. Love to you.
Lots of love. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Love Osho podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, you can show your appreciation by leaving a review on iTunes. Visit loveosho.com for new episodes, blogs,
and much more.